The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy,
but we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
A very happy Valentine's Day to all of you who are listening, and thank you for tuning in from the Space Show. Here's my Valentine's gift to all of you, since so many of you skip over the first 5 to 7 minutes of the show because you don't want to hear the announcements. I'm skipping all the announcements, so you're going to miss 5 to 7 minutes of the show. That's my Valentine's gift for you today. But you can still call us at 1-866-687-7223 and email drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. And then the only other thing I'm going to tell you is to please don't forget that we are brought to you in part by the great organization, the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And our special Valentine's Day guest, who is not going to be my Valentine after he gets through with this show today, because I know what he's going to say about our fiscal year 12 view of NASA, the budget, and everything related, and my heart is aching. It's not supposed to ache on Valentine's Day, is none other than our friend Robert Zimmerman. Bob Zimmerman is back with us, and he really needs no introduction, but Bob has a great blog that has been foretelling things that are materializing way back into early 2010. It's behindtheblack.com. You ought to be checking it out because he's turning out to be a good soothsayer. He's very well published. He's very famous. He's on the John Batchelor Show quite a bit. He has outstanding books, all of which are on the website. And I want to cut short my introduction because I want to get right into today's program. And we're starting. No announcements. So those of you who like to skip the show, you're going to have to go back and listen to the first 5 or 6 minutes. Bob, should I even dare say Happy Valentine's Day to you? Is this a heartbreaking day, or should we all be happy?
No, not at all. I'm always hopeful, and I always think that the political craziness that goes on in D.C. is always a negative. No matter how much money they pour at you, it's always negative. So when they don't pour any money at you, you're probably better off because you have to then suddenly be creative and you get more things done. And so, yes, today, as I pointed out on Behind the Black, today is Budget Announcement Day in Washington. Every year in the budget process, the president proposes the budget at the start of the year for the next year's budget. So right now, at the beginning of 2011, they are announcing the president's proposal for the 2012 budget. This gives Congress the rest of the year to slice, dice, and rearrange what they think the budget should be before they approve it. Of course, most of the last few Congresses have been completely incompetent and haven't even gotten to the approval process. But either way, today, the Obama administration announced its budget for the federal government, its proposal for 2012. For this particular show, the focus, of course, is always on what they're going to do with NASA. And that budget is basically flat. They're not increasing they're not proposing to increase NASA's budget at all, which is probably an unusual recognition of reality from the Obama administration. They don't normally notice the reality of politics going on around them. They make proposals and have been for the last 2+ years ignoring the realities of politics. But this time I think they recognize the election in November means that the Congress is not going to be interested in increased money. And so at least with NASA, it's a flat budget. They made a big deal in their budget announcement overall that they were going to try to reduce the deficit over the next decade. I haven't analyzed the whole budget by any means. I've just looked at NASA proposals. But from what I can gather, there are a lot of people who are saying, who are coming across quite skeptical of that claim. Either way, their budget for NASA is generally flat. If we focus in on the manned space portion of it and the continuing battle between Congress and the Obama administration over the issue of whether they should build a new some form of NASA rocket and capsule versus having NASA buy the product from many different companies, it appears to me that the Obama administration is losing heart with the in the idea of commercial space. They're proposing less money for that idea than they had last year, and that leaves them easily vulnerable in negotiations to trimming it even more.
Let me stop you for a minute,
sure.
Because it doesn't make rational sense. I know this is in the world of government budget, so why even think rationally? We don't even have a fiscal year 11 budget. We're still operating until early March under the old CR because the Congress wouldn't pass the budget.
The continuing resolution.
Yeah, so we don't even know what NASA, if we just confine this discussion to space, we don't really even know what NASA is going to get. And then when you see the CR language that is going to be debated for fiscal year 11 on this week on the House floor, it's even more mysterious when it's got language in there that says you're not allowed to do anything with China, including eating a Chinese meal. I mean, do these people even deserve to be our representatives and get some pay? We're talking now fiscal 12. We have no fiscal 11 budget.
Well, all right. Now, wait. I want to interrupt.
Go, yeah,
several
dude.
Things. No, I have to interrupt because you're making some points that aren't that we have to be clear on it. When you cannot just say to Congress, should these guys even deserve their job? The continuing resolution situation we're in right now was the result of the incompetence of the previous Congress.
Correct.
Made up significantly of a significantly different group of people.
Correct.
Whether this Congress that exists today is competent is a different question.
But the Chinese
you should not blame this Congress for the continuing.
The Chinese resolution. Language is this Congress.
Well, the Chinese language is probably a reflection of the new Congress's distrust of the Obama administration's of the Biden administration in general and how confident they are that this administration might let American secrets end up in China, which is not a friendly country.
I hope some people call in who were at the meeting last week in Washington, D.C., the AIAA meeting, and I'll let them tell you, because the guys from the government stood up and talked about American manufacturing, but we need to outsource the jobs, and we'll be happy if we get 40% of the labor done here in the United States. The listener who's listening, who knows who I'm talking about, I hope you're able to call in and tell us about that, because I didn't hear it. I wasn't there. And unfortunately, the transcripts or the audio are not on any website from that meeting that I can find. But, I mean, really, and then you can't even have a Chinese dinner? I mean, God almighty.
Look, I agree, but you know what? I don't even think that's the issue right now that's of the most import. The issue still, to my mind, is the federal government as a whole being an out-of-control madhouse that is bankrupting the nation. And NASA falls in that hole.
But it escaped big budget cuts, at least from the administration side.
In the past, it has. Up until now, even with an attempt to try to cut the budget, its budgets up until now, NASA's actually was getting the last 7 or 8 years increases above the rest of the budget. So the Congress had been favorable to NASA. But I think the situation is so changed in the last few years with the way Congress allowed the budget go completely wacko since 2006, and the deficit has ballooned four times what it had been in previous years, and now the debt has ballooned to numbers that are astronomical, that I think the game has changed, and NASA is not in a favorable position. It may be still in a better position than a lot of other government agencies, which means it might survive better than others. But in terms of getting more money, I think that's almost impossible.
Well, tell us what one of the issues really dear to the heart of the Space Show listeners. And listeners, I'll open the toll-free line up in a few minutes. So it's not available right now, but I'll tell you when I'm opening it up. Dear, as you know, to the Space Show audience is commercial launch industry, the ability for the SpaceXs and orbital and the new space industry to flourish, and for you know, NASA to buy a ride rather than try to design and control a ride.
Yes.
So where do we stand with Physical 12 from what you can tell? I know the budget's only been out for a couple of hours.
Well, I actually managed to skim through this 800-page document. Of course, I didn't read it closely, but I did look closely at the exploration section and actually the astrophysics section and a little bit at the earth science section, and those are the biggest ones. The exploration issues, it breaks into two areas. Now, I want to come up with terms so everyone knows what we're talking about. When I say commercial space, I'm referring to that part of the budget whereby NASA will buy products from companies like SpaceX or Boeing, and those companies will build the capsule and the rocket and provide the service to NASA to get crew and cargo into space. This was an idea pushed by the Obama administration last year, surprisingly, coming from a liberal politician. This is a very conservative idea. That's the commercial space half. The other half is the program formerly known as Constellation, which is where NASA builds and designs the rocket itself to provide it the capability of getting into space, and therefore it owns the rocket and controls the use of the rocket, and it's designed specifically for its needs and really doesn't have any other purpose. Well, the Obama administration was trying to kill Constellation last year entirely. They were very aggressive, almost in times illegally aggressive, in trying to shut that program down. And there were many people who argued, I think reasonably, that that wasn't a poor approach in the context of trying to get the commercial space half going. But rather than have this be a Soviet-style government program, let's let private companies compete to provide the services. The budget as, and so in that proposal last year, the Obama administration proposed to give $1 billion a year to commercial space and to completely eliminate Constellation. Congress did not agree with that because of a lot of pork reasons, I think. Constellation provides pork to a lot of districts, and it provides a lot of money to big aerospace companies that have been living off of the trough of NASA for decades. And so Congress came back to the Obama administration and trimmed $1 billion a year for commercial space down to $300 million for this year and $500 million for 2012. That's what the authorization passed last year provided for commercial space. But that same authorization insists that NASA go ahead and build a heavy-lift rocket in conjunction with the Orion capsule. That heavy-lift rocket was no longer going to be called Ares, so it's the program formerly called Constellation, but it's essentially the same Constellation program, except Congress didn't give them as much money as they had in the past, and they gave them less time to do it. And since there wasn't enough money in the past to build that rocket, it's almost more impossible for NASA to get it built now. And in fact, NASA's gone to Congress this year several times and said, look, we would love to do what you've authorized us to do. We recognize by law we have to, but you haven't given us enough money or time. It's not going to be possible. And Congress says, tough luck, do it anyway.
Oh, no, they actually said, try again.
Well, they're basically saying, sorry, you got to do it. And this is, once again, it's not just the Obama administration that is divorced from reality sometimes. Now, so the new budget that the Obama administration proposed today, now that I've given you the background, for commercial space, they're proposing about $850 million a year starting in 2012 for that program, which is more by $350 million than what Congress has authorized. However, it's less than what they proposed just last year. So that strikes me as they're already beginning to back off from their own proposals, and I never expected this administration to be very aggressively to fight for those proposals. And on top of that, it's very clear that they have bought hook, line, and sinker, the program formerly known as Constellation, because there seems to be now $4 billion a year being devoted to that program. And I haven't been able to slice the numbers completely to find out if that's a significant increase, but I think it is. I think it's about $1 billion more a year. But I haven't confirmed that estimate. That's from memory, so I could be wrong. But it seems to me the administration has given up its battle to eliminate the government-built program and instead has decided to go along with the program formerly known as Constellation. The problem is that they still haven't proposed giving that program as much money or time as it needs to get the thing built. So from my perspective, it's nothing more than pork. It's a program that will never get built. There's not enough money in it. It's basically keeping Congress happy to distribute dollars to their various districts, to the various aerospace companies to keep jobs alive. Whether anything will ever get built is probably almost nil. I'm very skeptical. Now, in terms of the commercial space half, that's going to go into negotiations with Congress. Since that program itself doesn't carry a lot of pork weight, it's not it doesn't exist yet, or if it does exist, it's not a lot of jobs, so it doesn't mean a lot to a lot of congressmen. It would be a very easy target to cut in this next budget, and I am not optimistic that even the $500 million that Congress authorized last year is going to survive when the budget negotiations go on, especially with the Obama administration coming in with a lower number this year than they proposed last. That's how I see it. So I expect commercial space to suffer significantly in the budget conference, and I also think that unfortunately, this will be a case of demonstrating that the sincerity of the budget cutters in Congress. I think that the Constellation program, the program formerly known as Constellation, is going to get its dollars, and that will show how insincere they are about cutting money.
You have a caller on hold that has been patiently waiting, and I believe our caller is Dr. Lurio. Charles, is that you?
Yes, I am right here.
Hey, Charles.
Welcome to Fantasy Island.
No, this is the one place in the world that's totally in reality. What do you mean?
What, Charles?
Hello?
You have the microphone. Go for it, Charles.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wanted to start with something that I heard Bob mention, this business about they're not, you know, they're proposing only $300 million over last year for commercial crew. I think, by the way, I think that, yes, they have pulled back a little bit, somewhat, and I'm uncomfortable with it on commercial crew in terms of they're not proposing the order of magnitude that they were talking about in the FY11 original proposal. But the point here is that when you say that they're proposing $300 million more than I think there's a little confusion being perpetuated out there. The actual amount that was authorized in the end for FY11, which is not to say, as you rightly pointed out, that it will be actually appropriated, was $312 million.
Yes, that's correct.
The projected amount in that compromise authorization was $500 million for 2012.
Right.
So the proposal is at 850 is on the order of $500 million plus over the actual authorization for 2011.
Yes, but Charles, remember we're talking about 2 years, 2011 and 2012. And in 2011, the authorization said 312, and in 2012, they said it would be $500 million. So this budget we see today has nothing to do with 2011. It is basically having to do with 2012.
Yeah, but it's still a substantial increase over the authorized amount for 2011. Let's not get stuck on that. But I still think are people going to be comparing on the Hill to the original proposal for 2012 in that authorization, or to the actual amount that was authorized in the previous year? I think that the latter is more reflective of the net difference. But anyway.
Charles, that your point is well taken. I mean, in terms of actual negotiations, when Congress starts to argue about these numbers, they're going to compare the authorization number of $500 million with the proposed $850 million by the Obama administration, and they're going to negotiate from that. But this Congress, especially the House, isn't going to accept the $500 million number right off the bat. And the gamble here is, even though it's a conservative concept to let private space do this, the push right now is to just simply try to get the deficit under control. And that means maybe let a private enterprise do it entirely and just get the government out of it. And that's what I'm expecting to happen, actually.
Well,
I really don't think this program is going to survive the negotiation.
However, I do think you're taking too negative a view of its prospects. On the other hand, the amount of money that for the commercial crew that they're talking about awarding in March for FY11, sort of FY11, let's not get into that, is on the order of $200 million, not even the $312 million. So the guys at NASA certainly took into account the fact that they don't know what the hell is going to come out of appropriations, if anything, you know. So, I mean, you know, they were already playing their own game there.
I have to say there's an aspect of this that's important. I wrote about this on Behind the Black. I had a long essay where I talk about squealing like a pig. And the one problem we've got, and the reason as a nation we have a problem, is because everybody wants the federal government's budget to be brought under control until they get to the program that they care about. And I care a great deal about space, but I ain't going to play the game of squealing like a pig, whereby I want my program protected, but let's cut everybody else's. I think right now that space has to share some of the pain that this nation has got to start facing to get our budget under control. And I'm very strong on this, Charles. I really think that our space industry is more robust than we think and can survive without a dime from NASA. And the truth is that in the end, they will get money from the government when the government finally gets its act together, because the government is a customer that needs to buy this product. So I think there is going to be money from the government, but I think right now to try to beg the government for money is a mistake. It's also not responsible as a citizen for us to do it, and that's how I stand. I'm not going to be one of those people squealing.
Let Charles.
No, all right. I had to say that. I had to insert that in. I want people to know where I stand.
No, I
on
recognize
this.
Your position,
go ahead, Charles.
Bob, and I, you know, and I respect it. You know, my position is. And in fact, I was just typing a draft thing for my newsletter, the first draft, in which I was saying that, you know, basically the question is not whether, how necessarily, perhaps the question, given the vast budget uncertainties, is not whether NASA ever gets enough money to, encourage multiple private providers, which is something that, they've talked about ideally, and instead perhaps it should be that can they assist the nation industry far enough to reduce the investor uncertainties far enough that it can proceed entirely and take off entirely on its own momentum. And let me add to that as a footnote that I know of people who say, just as you indicate, that there are that, in fact, that can happen without that NASA input. Some of them are close to some of the actual technical efforts, and some of them are not.
Well, that's interesting.
So, but let me put it
yeah,
this way. I it would be nice. You know, this is why I'm also why I'm not trying to be too overwrought about the budget stuff in my write-up this time. But anyway, I was at that meeting last week.
Yeah.
And what David mentioned was particularly in particular was that we had Ray LaHood, the Secretary of Transportation, get up there and talk about how huge rail, high speed rail initiative was just like the interstate highway thing. And after all, we didn't know how we'd pay for it then, back in the '50s when Eisenhower signed the thing. And
that's a lie.
that too. But besides which, the fact that obviously we were we were on top of the world there in terms of, you know, we weren't in hot to insane amounts
yes.
to another country at
yes.
that time. And let's just leave aside those small things. He then goes
yes.
on to make these comments about how he's been traveling through all these countries with wonderful technologies like Spain and other European and Asian countries. And, you know, all we're asking for them is that they spend 40% of their dollars in the U.S. with U.S. workers when they bring their great technologies to the U.S. for this. And I'm thinking, this is America today? I mean, this was, you know. So anyway, I don't know that I need to say much more. But as far as,
Did he get a standing ovation when he said that?
No, not from the crowd. I think there was a certain amount. There were may have been a few people there who were going, thinking, rah, 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 I really want to ride on a train that can only go half its rated speed because, you know, we can't, you know, go through.
It's interesting that he mentioned Spain, because for every green job they have attempted to create, they've lost two regular jobs. Their economy is close behind Greece.
Yeah, that aspect of his mentioning Spain was not lost on me.
You know,
I've
done shows with people from Spain who are dying to be here because
right.
there's no space, there's no science, there's no R&D. There's zilch, zero in Spain. Good paella, but other than that, you know, and I don't want to knock Spain, but come on, to use that as a 60% of our product will be made in Spain, and they'll be kind to do 40% over it. Cool.
Well, anyway, so that was the exciting moment of that conference.
So, Charles, what's the new space take on what? Because Bob and I don't bring a totally traditional new space view to the budget.
Let me interrupt for a second. Just to insert, I mean, I'm getting a little bit of a sense from, like, Clark Lindsay's webpage that, and from a few other notices supporting the Obama administration, that there's generally happiness with this proposal. And as you said, Charles, I could see why, because they're trying to push for more money than what was in the authorization, so they're still trying to get that budget up, it appears. I have consistently been more than skeptical about their ability to get any money for these programs. I was actually surprised the authorization kept any of it alive at all. But I get the impression that New Space community is generally satisfied that they're getting something. Yeah, that's mine.
Well, you know, given the amount of the number of pressures on things that they haven't totally bailed is a positive. In a sense. Now, what will happen to a lot of programs, there's a big question mark as to what will happen to funding for a lot of small but important programs like this suborbital research cruiser program and other.
You're squealing, Charles.
Excuse me?
Those are important programs. We have to save those programs. I'm tired of it. I've lived my life the last 50 years where
oink,
we can't
oink.
Cut any budget because everybody says their program's important. And I have
no,
to say...
No, you know, you can say that all you like, Bob. I'm not saying things won't happen otherwise. I'm just saying, you know, these are, you know, how long do people keep, how much tougher is it? I mean, if they keep on funding a pointless ex-constellation program, you know, and people are going to continue watching, how much time are people going to spend on suborbitals or whatever versus watching continued developments at the Taxidermy Museum, which is my new characterization of NASA.
Your point. Once again, your point's well taken. The difficulty in this issue is deciding what programs are important versus which are not. But my approach to this right now is that there is no sacred cow, even among programs I love or think are important. We have been, as a nation, it's been impossible for us to get our federal government and any budget under control because nobody wants to cut anything.
Bob, does this mean that you're willing to take cuts in Obamacare now?
Yes, I would like that program. Have you read my webpage? I must.
I'm kidding you, guys.
Kill the damn bill,
guys. I have a question for you both, okay? Because I'm going to keep this on some sort of a target.
Okay.
This is Bill from Virginia. Please ask Charles and Bob how they see the Mideast shift, specifically Egypt and Tunisia, so far affecting our space program, especially military space.
All right, Charles, you want to go first, or should I?
I think it's too early to tell. I think there are legitimate arguments that whatever regime emerges in Egypt will not be in Iran. There's been this talk that will be more like Turkey. In fact, I've heard that discussed on the Bachelor show, and I read, so, you know, as far as, what was the question again about the...
Well, we wanted to know how this related to our, the future of space.
What do you think will it have an impact on space?
Military space.
Well, military space, I mean, I think it's too early to tell.
Charles is partly right, but I'm less optimistic about the situation in Egypt. When Egypt started to unfold, and Tunisia both, I thought, oh, this is cool. People are rising up. Maybe we'll see hints of freedom in the Middle East. But as it unfolded, I became much less enthusiastic about the situation, not so much because I know it's an expression of a desire of these people for freedom, but the circumstances in the nation, especially in Egypt, is not necessarily favorable to a good outcome. And in fact, I think we're faced with a possibility of a very bad outcome out there right now.
I think that scares
me quite a bit.
I think we should send Charlie Bolden back over there to show what space can NASA can do.
You need
do
a different administration to do that.
I'm being sarcastic.
I know you are. The thing is that I agree with Charles, it's too early to tell, but I'm very pessimistic about the situation in the Middle East because we have throughout the Middle East, and this is not a, this is, it, to connect this with space to me is a, it's really a stretch. We have in the Middle East a serious, fundamental, cultural problem. We have a very radical, violent religion beginning taking dominance throughout that Middle East and using the money from oil and the power that gives them to fuel the growth of that very radical, violent religion. And so this revolution that occurred in Tunisia and in Egypt threatens to strengthen that, not the things we'd like to see strengthened, but strengthening that radical, violent religion. And as a nation, the United States has not been really willing to face this threat seriously in the last decade. I'm not, under Bush was it very seriously dealt with, not to my mind, and it's not being dealt with at all by this Obama administration. And that's a key issue. Now, how does that relate to space? The only area it relates has to do with using the money from oil and the wealth that these nations are getting to build militaries and military power. And in Iran in particular, they are moving and trying very hard to not only develop ICBM rocket technology that can put things in orbit, but to build nuclear weapons. And when you have a nation in the hands of a violent, radical religion with that kind of power, it's extremely worrisome. How does that relate to space? It means we have to somehow be able to defeat that military power, and space is one of the components in which to do it. It's hard to do that.
While Bill did not ask for me to opine on that, my thought is, way too early to tell how this is going to play out politically. But on the economic side, if the energy prices keep going up, and if scarcity and supplies exist because of political structuring over in the Middle East, the Suez Canal, the pipelines, you know, all of that infrastructure, and we start coming up with policies saying more and more alternative fuels, more and more green stuff, which doesn't really filter into reality yet, and maybe someday it will. The economy is going to be hit again and again and again. So how does that affect what the government is going to spend money on what people focus on in terms of being able to hold on to their jobs, their houses, buy gasoline, transportation, travel? I mean, that's the economic juggernaut we might be facing because of this could thwart a lot of things in the federal budget, including space. And that's how I see the connection. On the military side, again, if we're in a rational world here, military, space, intelligence, all of that should really, really take a serious look at how they miss things and what they have to do to, you know, keep us all safe and stay informed. And I would think military space should get a real boost in what they're doing. I don't believe in just throwing money wildly at a problem, but something's not working right if we're botching our intelligence, and it appears that we do somehow botch it. So I would think military space ought to get increased priorities out of all of this. But again, just to throw money at it doesn't solve the problem.
You know, this is getting back to my repeated point. I think that almost every single major federal agency has not had a problem with money for decades, including the intelligence industry. They might have a problem with having too much cash, which makes them lazy, and they haven't been doing good work because of it. A cutback in budget might force them to be a little bit better at what they do.
Well, one could only hope, but
I mean, I think the amount of inefficiency throughout the federal government is beyond description, and it applies to every agency, and it's reflected in their inability to do good work in any area. The whole situation in the Middle East and Egypt and Tunisia caught the federal government intelligence departments completely by surprise, and their main intelligence chief has gone around saying things that demonstrate him to be completely unaware of what the realities are.
Or incompetent, but just throwing money at them to put more satellites up won't solve that problem. But
they have the resources to do this work properly now. In fact, they could have fewer resources and do it better probably.
So I hopefully, and then I'll give it to you, Charles, hopefully I would think that for military space that this is a water-breaking thing that shows that they got to do something vastly different in order to, you know, have better information, however the military and the intelligence agencies get it. And it's not about throwing money at the problem, though I wouldn't be surprised that we might need better deployable assets. But clearly something has to change. You got it, Charles. And then I want to open the line to other people.
Right. And that's exactly why I wanted to throw in one concluding note and then get out of the way. And directed to Bob in particular. Let me say that the interpretation of the Obama 2012 budget proposal as saying, you know, we're really sort of giving with commercial crew and that kind of stuff. We're really lackluster interest and so forth. There are, based upon past experience, and certain indicators in the last day or so, I believe that it is in the interest of certain traditional contractors who will swap up the ex-Constellation money forever to continue to perpetuate that particular message, because, you know, that means they get more for their thing, you know, or they're less likely to be cut versus the commercial work. So you know, I think it sort of goes into the hands of guys that we would not want, entities that are pretty piggish and want to continue to be with absolutely no care for the
space,
the actual outcome, to a priori say, oh, this is Obama saying, throwing up his hands about, and the administration saying, throwing up their hands about commercial crew.
See, it's interesting to me, Charles, that this budget proposal appears to have accepted the program formerly known as Constellation and is pushing for it aggressively.
But it's a joke. We all both know it's a joke.
Well, we know it's a joke, but I'm talking now just about the Obama administration's approach. They seem to have accepted it, and they're accepting what Congress wants here. And we both know the real thing that Congress has wanted, the previous Congress at least, the previous Congress, was to keep funneling that cash to
absolutely
the big aerospace companies as pork. That's really
right.
What
and,
was going
and,
on. It was not to build a heavy lift rocket.
And I believe that certain aerospace companies that we know and don't particularly love like to portray in the media, and I won't mention any particular citations, but you might be aware of certain ones, in the last day or so, that in order to create a reality to their advantage, and if you come out and say, whoa, the administration has really slashed its interest in commercial crew,
you're specifically talking about the Wall Street Journal article.
I wouldn't name names here.
Well, I would. I have no problem doing that.
Charles.
Well, I don't want to, other than the fact that I don't want to get sued by the Wall Street Company.
Yeah, neither do I, by the way. Hey,
you know,
Charles.
It's unfortunately, certain people in the media get briefings from a single source too often and get into that habit.
Charles, wrap it up so I can give the line to others.
That's it.
Okay.
So please, Bob, please, can you keep that into consideration?
Oh, I'm aware of that. I read the Wall Street Journal article that came out last night, and it struck me as that it was definitely pushing for the program formerly known as Constellation, and would want to take its side against commercial space. I recognize that, but I'm also very aware of what the Obama administration is doing, and their budget proposal to me has very clearly, it strikes me as it's very clearly accepting the pork that the last Congress tried to force upon them of Constellation.
It's a matter of degree, and what your bottom line on it is, I think, is what I'm saying is something where I would tend to say it's not the wholesale abandonment.
I hope you're right.
That should be characterized that way, in my opinion.
Hey, gentlemen, I think maybe I should ask Andy to be a guest on the space show to talk about his perspective. What do you think?
Yes, that's a good idea.
I'm not going to say anything about that. All I can say is that.
I hope you'll listen to the show if he doesn't.
No, I don't. I'm already having enough of a cardiac arrest right now. But anyway.
Hey, Charles, one last thing. Seriously, off the air, do you have or can you get me the email address to Major General Joe Engel, who spoke at the conference? I'd love to invite him on the show to talk about X-15 flights and things like that.
That I don't have, unfortunately, but it was a wonderful, wonderful presentation, and that, in fact, is going to be integral to my next newsletter.
Do you know anyone who knows him? I guess I could go to my friends at AIAA and get it.
I don't know right now, but I know. Oh well, wait a minute. You know who the fellow at there is the guy at the FAA commercial.
Oh, George Nell knows him.
No, if you're willing to say the name, it was Van Lack.
Say who?
I forget what his first name. Van Lack.
Oh, Van. Okay. Well, I don't know him.
He's a personal friend of, and I may have his.
Well, if you have his contact, can you please send it to me?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, he introduced him, and he said he was a personal friend of Engel.
All right.
So
thanks, Charles.
All right.
Bye-bye, Joe.
Take care.
Okay, listeners, the toll-free line is all yours again. 1-866-687-7223. Let's take a break from the budget for a minute because you have an out-of-context question.
Okay.
And then we'll go.
Take a break from the budget.
Yeah, and then we'll go back to the budget and credit cards. Jack Kennedy you wrote a Sky and Tell article about the proposed new space telescopes. What impact do you see on the
future?
Well, it's not really out of, and I got phones already ringing in. What impact do you see of future budgets on big science, in quotes, space scopes, and which space telescope do you believe will deliver the most cumulative space science knowledge this year? That's interesting, this year.
Oh, well, I can answer the second part of that question right away, and that's Kepler, without doubt. Kepler is, and we're not even seeing the data yet from Kepler for the most of its time in orbit. The data that was released last week that made big splash about 1,200 new exoplanets.
Right, I saw that.
That was only for the first 4 months of Kepler's mission. They have not released that for the first 4 months from May to September 09. We have not seen the data from anything after September 09. That's more than a year and a half of further data. They are still holding that data as they analyze it. So Kepler is going to be producing ungodly amounts of results over the next few years, which to my mind once again demonstrates the absolute godlike value of putting an optical telescope in space, because even though Kepler's mirror is tiny compared to Hubble, look at the data it's going to produce, and it's wiping away every other result that you could imagine.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Now, in terms of the future of the astrophysics budget in general, it's dire, it's terrible, it's bad, it's horrible. Can I put it any more clearly? I'm being a little vague. They are in big trouble. I wrote the cover article I had in Sky and Tell in March was specifically on this. They came out with a decadal survey. That's their survey, which they make their prediction. The astronomy community recommends what it would like done over the next decade. And basically what NASA said is we can't build anything until we get the James Webb Telescope launched. And the James Webb Telescope, originally budgeted at $1.6 billion, is approaching $6 billion now. And it's years late. They're going to probably delay it till 2015, its launch. And until it gets up, it basically eats up the entire astrophysics space budget for NASA. They can't really do anything else. And the decadal survey recognized the fact that by 2020, at the end of this decade, most of the operating space telescopes that exist now are probably not going to be operating anymore, and we're not going to be replacing them because nothing's getting built because Webb is using the whole budget. So it's a very bad situation. You talk to astronomers, they're not happy. They committed themselves on Webb at the beginning of 2000, sometime in early the first decade, 2001, and it's basically destroying space astronomy for two, maybe three decades. It's going to be a wonderful, spectacular, great infrared telescope, not optical, when launched. It doesn't replace Hubble, assuming it works, of course. But it's eating away the budget.
And that's where the main problem is in the astrophysics budget.
At this moment, that tied in once again with the general shape of the federal budget. The astronomy community recognized that their budget was going to probably be flat anyway for the next decade because of the federal budget situation. And unfortunately for them, Webb is then eating into the flat budget they have. We are faced possibly with cuts to that budget because of the financial situation that NASA is in right now.
Well, I'll squeal like a pig to keep that budget up.
Well, you know, you'll be like everybody else. my program is more important than yours. I've written about this for a decade and a half. It's a favorite of mine as well. It's a great tragedy, but it's a little more complicated than just the federal budget because here the astrophysics community itself has dug its own grave. But the irony is that that James Webb was designed to serve the cosmology clique of astronomy, the people who like to study the Big Bang and the very, very, very distant most stars. It's designed to do that. It can do other things, but that's what it was built to do. And unfortunately, astronomy is a much wider field than that, and the astronomy community has allowed the cosmologists to dominate them. And because of that, a lot of other astronomy is going to suffer over the next few decades.
You have another caller.
Sure.
Caller, are you with us, please?
Hello? I am. It's Trent from Australia.
Go ahead,
hey.
Trent.
Hey, Trent. Howdy.
So, yeah, when I talk to astronomers, they say, yes, it's terrible that it's delayed, but no, we don't want to cancel it because it's the best thing you could possibly be doing with the money right now. So
well,
that seems to be a pretty widespread, you know, opinion around astronomers.
What the hell was that?
Second fine.
I think if they contributed to the space show, they'd be a hell of a lot better use for the money.
I won't argue with that.
And they get a tax donation on top of it.
There are a lot of astronomers who will say that, absolutely, but they're saying that, they say that generally to the general public because they don't want to say bad things publicly. They want to support what's being done publicly. They're afraid that they'll get that project canceled if they don't do that. But yeah, I talk to enough astronomers, more privately for too many years now, and the real dope is there are a lot of unhappy people in the astronomy community over WEB. Not that they don't want it launched, but they're unhappy that so much of their resources are being devoted to just one particular area of the field. And they would have rather not that happen.
What else, Trent?
All right, so I'm watching Bolden on NASA TV, and boy, you can see why he's been avoiding the cameras for the last 6 months or so. But I hear him saying the word milestone-based a lot for the CCDev.
The what-based? Say it again, what-based?
Milestone-based.
Oh, milestone-based, okay.
Which is a bit of a sore point with me because, you know, we're waiting for the financial 11 budget to be actually appropriated to see how NASA actually does this new start of the commercial crew and how they arrange the contracts and whether or not they actually do make it milestone-based, right? I mean, the thing that made COTS so good was that the bids don't get the money in advance. They have to raise their own capital, and then when they complete milestones, and admittedly the milestones are quite small, they get paid a performance bonus, right? They get paid, you completed this milestone, you get this amount of cash, and then you can use that to do the next milestone, right? But we haven't seen that with Commercial Crew at all. The only money that's been spent has been the $50 million in stimulus money, and that was just given in advance, and they have to do their quarterly reports the same as everyone else who does stimulus money work. So I was going to ask the question because I don't know the answer and I don't know if you know the answer, but are we ever going to see a financial year 11 budget, or is there just going to be no work done for financial year 11?
I don't know the answer to that question either. I'm not sure how they're going to handle this. I suspect there will be a budget, but it will be just a pro forma budget because the year's already passed. The money's been spent. They can't go back and re-spend it differently. So that's all I can say. I'm not sure myself. I can tell you this. Bolden reminds me often of Sean O'Keefe in this. If you look just even in how they announced this budget in the press releases, NASA announces plan to win the future with fiscal year 2012. Sean O'Keefe was very much into sloganizing and coming up with bureaucratic terms to try to explain how they're doing things better. Well, they weren't doing things better, but they came up with these cool terms. We're going to deal with stovepiping, and we're going to have spiral development. This was bureaucratic garbage. It didn't mean anything. It didn't really accomplish anything, but that's how we like to do things. Mike Griffin swept that all aside and focused very precisely on getting the job done. No terms, no bureaucratic terminology, just let's get the job done. Let's have fewer reports. Let's cut metal. And they really did focus that way. Whether they could have accomplished Constellation with the money and budget they had is a separate issue. But they really focused on getting the job done. And a lot of the talk about milestones, I don't think he has the slightest understanding of the meaning of the term. The milestones you described for COTS were concrete milestones designed to get the job done. The way Bolden uses such terms, they remind me of Sean O'Keefe. They're cool terms to try to sell how wonderful his bureaucracy is without really accomplishing anything. That's how it strikes me, all this stuff. I read the budget, and the budget is really designed as a public relations piece. It has little to do with reality in a lot of places, and it's filled with this kind of stuff, and it's garbage. It has little to do with getting the job done. And that's one of the reasons why I'd like to just eliminate the budget for NASA to a great extent these days, because I don't believe they're going to spend the money. In spending the money, they'll get the job done. That, I don't know if that answers your question, Trent, but that's my rant for the day.
I hear NASA people regularly talking about, you know, NASA providing seed money to commercial crew. And every time they say it, I grate my teeth, because the seed money isn't supposed to come from NASA, all right? That's pretty much what a cost-plus contract is. We'll pay your costs, and we'll provide the seed money, and then we'll give you a bit of a profit, and the job's done. And you never have to talk to anyone in industry. You never have to raise any funds. You never have to say, hey, where's my alternate revenue streams? How am I going to pay for this when NASA goes away?
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to be going that way even with COTS now. Is Orbital Sciences is saying, well, you know, if you really want to make sure that we succeed at completing our milestones, give us $100 million up front and we'll do a test flight, which, you know, SpaceX did on their own money because they wanted to launch satellites with that booster.
Right.
And it was, you know, that's not NASA's problem. NASA doesn't pay for us to test our rocket. They pay for us to complete the milestones and prove that we can do the job that they want us to do in our resupply contract.
You see, this is getting back, Trent, to what I said at the closing of my last appearance on the Space Show. If I had any of my druthers, I beg all the aerospace companies that are looking for this commercial space money that they don't take it. That they don't take it, that they go and they try to raise funds in the real world, build their rockets, and then they can sell that product to NASA later on in the game. But by taking the money up front, they are being co-opted into the Eisenhower term, the military-industrial complex, which in this case is just simply a money stream jobs program pork for Congress and these big aerospace companies. It's not focused really on getting the job done. I will say this, though. I want to insert one aspect of this that's interesting. SpaceX has really changed the landscape, and it's very invigorating to see a company like Boeing, for example, negotiating with India to possibly help them build their first manned space mission, which means Boeing is trying to market its crew capsule, and possibly in conjunction with the Atlas rocket, as a way, or maybe the Indian rocket, but its crew capsule, as a product to sell to another country, to a customer. And that is a very different approach than what Boeing has done in the past. And that is how I think SpaceX has changed the landscape. And I wish to God every one of the aerospace companies would do the same thing, get out of the mode of we survive only if we get government money, and instead get into the mode we survive by getting a good product that we can sell to everybody. Then we'd get some good space industry. We'd have a real space industry.
I think Boeing's gone and done that because they've spoken to someone at NASA and said, well, you know, as soon as you start giving us money, we'll start building our capsule. And that particular person, you know, is in the group of, no, it's going to be COTS-like, so we're not going to give you money up front to go and start building a capsule. We're going to expect you to come up with money and come up with customers, and we're going to pay you for completing, you know, a milestone, and it's going to be more like an incentive rather than a payment.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I think, you know, as soon as that goes away, Boeing and the others will also go away with that. And you'll see, you know, Virgin Galactic going oh, we no longer need your services. We don't need funds up front anymore. We're getting it from the government.
Yes, and this is why you're bringing back my skepticism of the Obama administration in the long run with commercial space. Because even if the money does exist, you know, even if they don't back off and they do get a bigger fund, they're going to reshape the program into the same thing we've seen for the last 30 years, a NASA-based program which has nothing to do with building an industry. That's my fear. I would say, too, that I've heard enough stories about the war going on within NASA between exploration and operations, with trying to keep the operations surviving in some manner, and that war could include co-opting the commercial space thing and bring it into the old operations mode, and that would be unfortunate.
Trent, anything else, or should I free the line?
Free the line. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Trent. Nice to hear from you.
Bob, we are at the top of the hour. It's a good point for at least one break during the show.
Sure.
So, everybody stay where you are. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is the Space Show, and we're talking to Bob Zimmerman. And you have a caller on the line, Terry from Corpus Christi. Hi, Terry. How are you?
Hey, just fine. How are you all?
Fine. Go for it.
Go for it.
Saw an article the other day on the Internet about possibly corporate sponsors coming up with $190 billion for a Mars mission. Is that even possible to get that many corporate people to come up with the money? And $190 billion really sounds on the short end on something like that.
Yeah, that sounds, Terry, like a very fishy article, very fishy story. That doesn't sound legit in any way, shape, or form. What does exist right now is that it's very likely that the next mission, manned mission to the moon, will be paid for privately by two tourists, and launched on a Soyuz capsule not to orbit the moon, but to go around the moon and come back to Earth, which was the original reason the Soyuz designed as it was. It was originally going to try to do that before we did it, and in the 60s. And they didn't get around. They lost the race, so they never did that with the Soyuz craft. But now they're offering tickets at initially it was $100 million a seat. Now it's up to $150 million a seat. And according to Space Adventures, they have a customer who has already put down a deposit at the $100 million price, and they're waiting. If they get a second tourist to fly, pay the $150 million, they'll have two people, and they will go on a lunar mission. That is more conceivable. A Mars mission, you know, I wrote a whole book on this, Leaving Earth. Going to Mars requires having a vessel that can travel and keep people alive for anywhere from 1 to 3 years. We don't, and they're self-sufficient, far away from home, able to operate it on its own, and be repairable from 70 million miles away by the crew, not by a shuttle mission flown to bring supplies up. And we don't know how to do that yet. It'll take several years of research, minimum, in orbit around the Earth with a space station to learn how to build that kind of vessel. The Russians were doing it with Mir. We are doing it poorly with ISS. But we need to learn how to build a spaceship that can get humans to another planet. And so that's going to take much more than $190 billion, and it's going to take a long time. And I don't see any. I don't see that. That does sound fishy to me.
What would be the payoff or the return for a corporate sponsor to do this? What how can they make their money back?
Well, it is, you know, corporate sponsorship by its very name, it's the publicity. A lot of the companies that helped build Apollo missions to the moon, Gemini and Mercury, did it for the publicity. It demonstrated that their company was on the cutting edge of technology, and it would help sell their normal products much better because they could say, well, we built the lunar module, fly our planes, buy our planes. And the same thing applied to Boeing and to a lot of the other aerospace industries in the 60s. To build a mission, this is why let me backtrack. This is why the Russians do it. It sells their spacecraft and Energia. It sells that company to the world. And so not only do they make some money on it, but it tells everybody that their spaceship is the best in the world. And so that would be a reason to do it. But a Mars mission is pushing the envelope. There's no reason. I mean, think about it. You could do it much more cheaply and much more effectively and sooner by doing, let's say, a lunar mission, or more likely tourists in space right now, Virgin Galactic. That makes much more sense from a corporate perspective. You get the same corporate public relations benefit for a lot less risk and a lot less money and much, much sooner. That's why the Mars story sounds fishy to me. It doesn't sound right. You stay at Terry still?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, it sounded fishy to me.
I don't know if that answered you. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it did fine.
Okay.
And we beat heavy lift to death, but why can't NASA just say, we've got an 8-month, 12-month time frame, and we're going to put out bids for the most cost-effective, and as soon as someone could come up with a viable heavy lift system, and that can include the Boeings, the Lockheeds, the New Space, SpaceX, all of those, throw it all in a hat and get together and just come up with the best option and go from there.
Well, to a certain extent, Terry, what you're describing is the difference. This is what we were talking about in the first hour of the show, the difference between commercial space and the constellation concept. The heavy lift idea that was basically micromanaged by Congress last year and will be built and designed by NASA is the way that's been the mode of operation for the last 35, 40 years. The way you're talking is more like the COTS commercial space idea, which is NASA has a need, and it will buy the product from whoever can provide it for them. And this is, as Trent pointed out earlier, the way to do that is a company comes up with and builds the spacecraft, as SpaceX does, and then there's a product then that NASA can buy, rather than NASA helping them design it. The trouble is that to do it the commercial space way takes the power out of NASA's hands. It eliminates the justification for all those engineers to work at NASA. There's no reason for them to be there. If commercial space is building the rockets and the capsules to put people in space, then why do you need a Johnson Space Flight Center? And think about it. There is no reason for a Johnson Space Flight Center, other than maybe a mission control for when the flights in orbit. But the truth of the matter, even that is significantly reduced by how SpaceX operates. They have their own mission control. It's small, it's cheap, it's kept very minimum, and it therefore saves them a lot of money. They don't want to use Johnson Space Flight Center's mission control. So that's why it doesn't happen. That's why you have this factional war between the government and private enterprise going on right now.
Do you think there's any possibility that SpaceX would just go ahead and say, we've waited long enough, we're going to make a band-rated Falcon 9, you know, with escape tower, and when we get it built, if you want to buy it from us, fine, or Bigelow or whoever, we're going to build it and not worry too much about the funding. I know it'd be a lot of money, but
Interesting question. It wouldn't surprise me if SpaceX went ahead and did that, because that's been their mode of operation. The reason Dragon capsule and the Falcon 9 rocket exists is not because of NASA contracts. It's because SpaceX wanted to build it. They took advantage of the COTS program to get financing, additional funds to make it possible. But Elon Musk said he was going to go ahead and build it. And he just happened to time very well and was able to obtain a COTS contract at the same time to help finance the project. So down the road, yes, it's very possible they will go ahead anyway. Once again, that story about Boeing in negotiation with India about helping them build a manned mission tells me that there are, once again, customers out there that you can sell a capsule to, a manned capsule to, as a product. Including Bigelow, by the way. It's not just India, but Bigelow as well. And so at some point down the road, if SpaceX starts to make money from its Falcon 9 rocket and the Dragon capsule, they might have enough cash to obtain the cash to invest, to put in the extra things they need to make it man-rated. And why not then go ahead?
Any idea how much it would cost for an escape system?
No, I don't know that off the top of my head. I know I've seen the numbers bandied about, but I can't remember the number off the top of my head. David, do you have any idea?
No, I don't know what they would estimate for that. Maybe someone will email it in to us.
Yeah, I could. I can't do it now because I'm on the phone, but I do a little bit of web searching. You can trace. You can pick it up. It's a what is it? What's the abbreviation? Launch Escape System, LES.
Or just do a Falcon 9 launch escape system and see what you come up with.
Some numbers. Actually a discussion. I saw a few articles specifically on that subject, so the number is known. It's just I don't know it off the top of my head.
Yeah, so just if anyone out there does it, email it in to us during the show. I'd like to see what it is. I'll read it on air.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, Trent already did that. $300 million for the escape system. So
yeah,
I'm assuming that's for the Falcon 9.
I'll bet you that's a number that has kind of been dictated to them by NASA, and I suspect it could be done for somewhat less. Not a lot less, maybe, but for somewhat less.
That's a lot of money in South Texas.
Well, yes, but think about how much it costs to build Falcon 9 and that Dragon capsule, and they managed to get it done.
$200 million for everything else, seats, controls, etc. So $500 million for test flights.
Yeah.
Thank you, Trent.
You know, it's interesting, but those test flights wouldn't cost as much as you think, because if they could combine it with some kind of cargo capacities, or maybe, put cargo in it, because the test to launch, anyway, you can't cargo it. If you're going to do a test flight of a launch escape system, you've got to actually abort your launch. So you can't get into orbit. So,
Terry, it's a lot of money any place except Washington, D.C.
That's right.
You know, so you got to get up into the trillions nowadays to be a lot of money.
If only that will change.
Anything else, Terry?
No, thank you very much.
Hey, I got a question for you, okay? Since
yes, sir.
Johnson is in Texas, I mean, not too far from Corpus Christi. Your assessment of the Texas population really following, liking, being involved in, knowledgeable about the space program?
Less than 10%.
And does that get better as you get closer to Houston?
Depends on the education level. From Houston to Galveston, of course, is the NASA area. Of course,
right.
It's going to be high in that area. Higher in the big cities because you have a higher concentration of higher educated people. They have the tendency of knowing more about what's going on. But as you get into the rural areas, it gets a lot worse.
10%. Interesting.
But I'm keeping the light in the window.
You might keep the shuttle light in the window, too.
I would be more optimistic than you, Terry, on that. And I also would not assume that rural is less interested than urban. If anything, my experience is, and I spend a lot of time in rural areas, is that rural people who are pretty educated on this stuff in this internet age tend to be My experience is they tend to be more likely than in urban areas to be enthusiastic for space. Urban people often are liberal and therefore hostile to such things.
Well, I told David before, in Texas, it's trucks and beer.
Well, you're in Texas. You can say that. I wouldn't.
Well, I will. And it kind of drops off from there as far as popularity.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
So, listeners, that opens up the toll-free line again, 1-866-687-7223. Bob, do you foresee such a, what would be the word, vigorous debate this year over Fiscal 12 NASA budget as we had last year, Fiscal 11 NASA budget?
Well, yes, but I think it's going to be in a very different context with a very different Congress. And it's going to be in the context of the federal deficit and the desire of Republicans in the House to get some control over that deficit. This has always been my pet peeve about most space discussion. It's every one of my books avoids this mistake. Space, because it's global and because it's usually related to military and missiles, is invariably linked closely to politics. You cannot talk about the history of space without linking it into the politics of the time. You can't talk about the technology even without talking about the politics of the time. It all ties in very closely. And because it's government funded and has been tragically for the last 40, 50 years since the beginning, it's tied invariably with politics. And so the political situation in the United States right now is going to determine the debate on NASA, and the political situation in our nation right now has to do with this deficit. That's been what the big issues have been over the last year and a half, that and the size of the federal government. And NASA has to, the discussion about NASA is going to be in that context.
Okay, Charles is depressing me again. Charles, you got to stop doing this. Here's his email on the cost of the launch escape system for Falcon 9. And now you'll see why. Charles, you're also not going to be my Valentine today, let me tell you, for breaking my heart. Okay, I'm going to quote from Charles's email. 300 million was Elon's number before he heard how many other tests NASA wanted. Then he said 1 billion.
Yeah, but see, that's getting back to what I said, which is that if he does it for NASA, they're going to inflate and make it difficult for many reasons. One, because their government, they want to cover their backsides, make sure every dot is I'd and every T is crossed, and so therefore they're super risk-averse, so it costs more money. That's one reason NASA will make it expensive. The other reason is NASA sees him as a threat, and they'll make it difficult for him. If he decides to go ahead and man-rate it himself, his only goal is going to be to make sure it's going to work, getting the job done. And it might cost him a third, if not a tenth, the dollars at that point. And it will work. And then he can start flying it, and people will fly on it. They might not be NASA astronauts, but there'll be people flying on it. And once it's flown a bunch of times, at that point in time, all this stuff from NASA will be irrelevant. It's a man-rated system.
So I have a question for you. It's not necessarily on the budget, but it's along the same times. I was doing some research, actually, for my show tomorrow night with Dr. Alan Stern, and I was looking up some of the details on the NASA Cruiser program, which is $15 million initially of money going into suborbital academic science and research payloads. And it said, here's a clarification for Cruiser, that this is not going to be any money that is allowed to go to any tended flight. And we've put Dryden's center, NASA Dryden, in charge, and nothing tended will ever be funded unless the crop of suborbital vehicles meets NASA's high standards for human safety on human spaceflight. Now, again, we're talking suborbital flights here. So that means that the Cruiser program is limited to non-human tended flights only, cargo flights only. And what the hell is NASA Dryden going to overimpose or superimpose over, you know, X-Corps and Virgin and the rest of them to make sure that their flights comply with NASA human spaceflight standards on a suborbital flight? Are they going to take a $200,000 trip into a $10 million trip?
Well, you see, once again, it's a turf war. We always have to be aware that power is a component in these discussions, and territory is a component. And NASA's territory, which has been to run space exploration for the last 50 years, is threatened by all these independent companies.
By suborbital flight, they're threatened?
Absolutely, because suborbital has been the control of NASA. They, you know, Wallops Island used to be where all suborbital flights were doing. Of course, it was essentially my uncle worked for Wallops Island, and they put a rocket together, you know, in their backyard, essentially. It was almost like the garage mechanics doing it in their basement. It's very simple and very effective and very efficient, and they do lots of aerodynamic tests without much money spent. But now it's a case of independent companies are going to start launching rockets, and NASA's trying some way to regain control over that. You know, right now, the licensing operation is supposed to be with the FAA. But NASA has actually issued a few papers and a few reports trying to say that it should be the one to license any kind of manned mission, even suborbital. They're trying to regain some turf. There's a war going on here. This brings us back to the budget, because if the Congress finally faces reality and starts to trim some of these bureaucracies, then they won't be fighting for the turf, because they won't exist. The turf doesn't belong to them. They want it to control it, but it doesn't really belong to them. It belongs to whoever has the freedom and the will to create something and succeed with it. And for a government agency to then come in and try to take control of it is despicable. But that's how governments function. They want control. They want power.
A couple more email questions for you here. This is from Jim Nobles, and he says, I wonder, Bob, if you have an opinion. You should never wonder about Bob having an opinion. Are you kidding? Bob has an opinion on what color shoelaces I should have in my shoes, and he's never seen them. Bob always has an opinion.
I do not have an opinion on that.
You don't have an opinion? Yeah.
No, I don't. How could I? I've never seen him.
Because you have an opinion on everything. I wonder if Bob has an opinion about the Bigelow and UAE connection. Does Bob think there's anything to it? What will come of it, if anything?
Well, I mean, there is a connection. They've signed an agreement. The United Arab Emirates has lots of money, and the UAE has tried to be a little more secular than much of the Arab world. They have tried very hard.
Very pro-commercial everything.
Yes, they've tried. And because of that, they made this deal, and they're looking at it as a way to make money and also a way to make their nation look advanced and on the cutting edge in a good way. And so the deal exists. And Bigelow, he's got a product. He's trying to sell it. That's his deal. And so what else can I say? That's the situation. The bottom line for that is, once again, they need a transport system to get up and down from these stations. And that's where we get back to commercial space again.
Well, maybe the Emirate Air will take off and go into space. They run such an incredible airline that they probably could do a really great job with rockets, too.
You know, that's an interesting point. It's an interesting...
Because they're commercial, profit-oriented all the way through.
Well, they might be so, but, you know, there's an extra cultural thing having to do with engineering and creativity. They might have the sense of how to make money, but they don't necessarily have the engineering resources to do it themselves.
No, that's true. They buy an Airbus or a Boeing jet.
Right.
And hey, listeners, don't send me the picture of the Emirates Air running off the runway into the terminal. I don't want to see it again. Look, there's human errors across the board in everything. You don't have to go any further than Washington, D.C. to see a whole list of human errors. So don't send me that picture. But if you haven't seen it, you ought to Google for it.
Yes.
Pretty interesting. Okay, Joe Luttrell, who's down there in Flying Saucer World in Roswell, has this question for you. What percentage of the population of the U.S. do you think really cares about our space program or even knows about commercial space? I think those are two different questions.
Well, you know, this is something that comes up repeatedly on this show and among space people all the time. Do people care? You asked Terry the question about Texas. And I tend to have a different opinion of most people. I really think that more people in the United States care about this subject than you think. They might not care about it as passionately as space people do. It's not something that they talk about a lot. But they really would like it when space achievements are accomplished. And the demonstration of that always is it's proven by the web more than anything else. And this story I might have told this on your show before, David, but in the 70s and 80s, it was extremely frustrating to find out anything about achievements in space because the mainstream media, which was very limited in those days, decided this was just not something very interesting to them, and so they wouldn't give it very much coverage, very cursory coverage. It was very frustrating to find out any information. When the 90s rolled around and the Internet showed up, the mainstream press still had this very blasé attitude towards space exploration, but NASA could post its own website so that anyone could go find out about it. And when Sojourner landed, that little first rover that NASA sent to Mars, landed on Mars and started to rove around, that website got like billions of hits. And it demonstrated the interest of the public in such a topic. And it has changed the landscape on how space is even reported. It gets coverage. And it gets coverage because people are interested in the subject. Now, whether they're passionate about a government space program or even private space is a little, it can be argued about. But people are interested in this because it's cutting edge, it's exploration, and at least in our culture, those are things that people are interested in. So I have a much more optimistic view towards that. The area of discussion is always in how much should the government or tax dollars be used for this process. And that's where you'll get a lot of people not so enthused, and for, I think, justifiable reasons.
So do you want to give him a percentage?
Who?
Joe, who asked the question.
Well, he wanted a percentage of what?
How many people in America like...
No, but I don't think you can give it a percentage. I would say, though, that almost every person in the United States who surfs the web is going to periodically click on a story about space exploration out of interest. And that they're not going to necessarily click on every piece, but almost everyone in the United States at some point will click on those stories. Not every story, but some of those stories. And I think that's the case, yes. I think, is that 100%? No, it's not, because that's 100% of the people who are going to click on a story doesn't mean that 100% are interested. But there's an interest in it, and I think it's a mistake to just because they're not passionate about discussing it all the time or look it up continuously, it doesn't mean that they're disinterested in the subject.
Let me ask Joe's question another way.
Sure.
We're approaching a presidential year campaign in 2012.
Oh my
God. We're approaching it. It's still off in the distance, but we're approaching it. And you certainly hear it from the pundits on a daily basis almost. If you have 30 national priorities in a list of mainstream top presidential candidates.
Oh, space won't be in.
Will space be in the top 30?
It might, but it might not. It doesn't necessarily have to be. Once again, this isn't to say it's not an important thing or it shouldn't be pursued. It's to say that depending on the circumstances, that greater context, you have to set your priorities on what's important. And I would tell you right now, and this is why I'm willing to say we should cut NASA's budget to zero even, there are more important priorities right now, significantly more important priorities that are going to take up. And there might only be two or three. There might only be one having to do with the federal government's out-of-control budget, but that could take up all your discussion time because it's such a difficult problem. It's such a difficult and serious problem. It's like during World War II, would you be arguing about whether or not the V-2 rocket should be developed for space exploration? Well, Wernher von Braun certainly wanted to do that, but that was not on the priority list at the time. And so once again, it's not a question of whether or not it's something people aren't aware of, or it's not a question of whether it's important. It's a question of the context of the debate, of the campaign itself. And space will not, I think, be a priority at that time. It'll be a factor because we will be dependent on the Russians to get up to ISS at the time. But I don't think it's going to be a high priority. No, not at all.
Paula in New York City has an email question. And she says, before I ask you my real question, I'll just comment that I listen to lots of the opinion shows on cable news, most every night. I think that the intelligence quotient of most of these people regarding space and science is below zero. And I honestly believe that space has no chance of being a national priority among most people, because most people get their news from cable or other sources where the people they're listening to don't know what they're talking about or are totally ignorant. That said, my question to Bob is, can you at all today, with some degree of accuracy, I'm not going to hold you to it, propose we will actually have a fiscal year 12 budget by September 30th, or will we again go to CR?
Oh, all right. Well, first, I want to address her first point about cable news. I agree with her entirely that most of the people you see on cable news, even if they know something, the problem is the very nature of the way cable news, all cable news, Fox down to MSNBC, is structured the way that you do it. It's a very poor way to get your information. But I will tell you that I do not agree that most people get their information from just that. I think as the nation, the culture is changing, and I think a larger and larger percentage of the population recognizes this is a very poor way to get information, and in fact it's a very time-consuming way to get information. If you want to get your information reasonably fast and in more depth, you can get it off the web.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And most people, I think most people recognize that. And it used to be you'd read your newspaper in the morning, but that's not as effective a way as spending a half hour in the morning doing some web surfing to get your update on the news. And you get much more information, much more accurate, from multiple sources. And I think the majority of the population is beginning to do that increasingly. So that has actually diffused the impact or power of the cable stations. Having said that, now, getting back to the continuing resolution, I haven't the faintest idea. I do know this, that the politics... I think I'm being optimistic here. I think the dynamics have changed. We have a different crop of candidates who are elected this year. This is not like 94, where the Republicans who took over Congress in 94 were still old hat politicians who, even though they did rein in the deficit in the late 90s, they were not really interested that much in shrinking the size of government. We did get some very different candidates elected in November who have very different philosophical positions about the importance of government and are quite willing to do some drastic cuts. And they're in positions of prominence because of they're different. And people are noticing that. And I think that dynamic puts this next year's negotiation under a very different light. Also, it means the Republicans, I think, are going to be stronger fighting the Democrats on this. I think the Democrats are politically weak, that the public does recognize the disastrous situation we face with the federal budget. That's also a change from the 90s, where the budget, though in deficit, was nowhere like it is today. So what does that mean in terms of a continuing resolution? I don't know, but I do know that it means that we are probably facing a different kind of budget cutting than we've seen in the past. For example, in the 90s, when the Republicans claimed they had cut the budget, they were lying. What they had done is they had reduced the size of growth enough so that the revenues caught up with the growth and we had a surplus. But the government continued to grow in size, the budget continued to grow, and that meant the government continued to grow. I think we are facing now a different political situation whereby we actually might see the government size shrinking, actual cuts. And I think that's because the public is beginning to recognize the desperate need for such things.
Not to my entitlements, they don't dare.
Well, you see, that gets back to, you know, no one wants their own axe to gore.
Of course.
Be gored. But I think that also is somewhat changing, and I'll use myself as an example. I'm willing to say this. And I was actually less willing to say this a decade ago. I was, you know, well, space is important. We should keep space. But I've gotten to the point now, no, we can't do that anymore. If we're going to be responsible citizens in a free country, we have to start to take some pain. And it might actually be for our own benefit to stop depending on the government here. That's the other side of it.
Well,
I think that we have to start looking at that. All of our entitlements are going to go bankrupt if we don't deal with it. And that means we have to deal with it. And that's facing reality and being mature about it. And it means it's like, one of the reasons Chris Christie, as a governor, has had so much impact is because he's willing to politely look union people in the face and say, look, we can't afford it anymore. I'm sorry, but that's life. And he gets applause. You watch his videos on the web where they post them repeatedly.
Yeah, no, they like it, but he's straight talking.
Straight talking, but he says exactly what I'm saying. He's willing to face reality, say, look, it doesn't matter how nice it sounds. We can't afford it, and you're going to have to bite the bullet. And the audience applauds. Because I think the public's beginning to recognize that if we don't face this, it's going to come back to haunt us in a much worse way.
You have another caller. Caller, are you with us, please?
Yes, ma'am.
And who are you?
I'm Kelly Stark.
Kelly. You sound too low to be Kelly.
Sorry. Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. Go for it, Kelly. What's on your mind?
Okay. This is about a half hour old, but I was going to mention one bit of information. The spiral idea that O'Keefe's guy actually quoted actually works. It's an industrial or military improvement cycle where you design something to meet the requirements, field it, test how well it's working, then develop improved requirements, just go through a spiral up as you go through this cycle. Which would actually be good as opposed to build one time, hope for everything, and then don't make any improvements for 30 years.
Kelly, that might be true, but that's not what Sean O'Keefe was actually doing at NASA.
What the hell O'Keefe was doing.
He might have used great terms, and the concepts might be wonderful, but that's not what he actually was doing. They spent the apocryphal story I like is how they had this job to build the crew exploration vehicle. They were given this job in, what was it, January of 04. A year later, when O'Keefe was gone, Mike Griffin comes in, and they still have not released a request for proposals. A year had passed. They had been doing meetings and discussions and meetings, and then they had more meetings, and they had committee reports, and they had additional committees and more meetings, but they hadn't actually released a request for proposals from anyone. They had issued they did issue a request proposal, but it wasn't really a proposal describing what they wanted. It was basically just a long list of paperwork they were going to require any contractor to fulfill if they were to build something. So, granted, he might have had some concepts that were nice, but that's not what he did. Sean O'Keefe was being polite here, was not a good administrator for NASA.
Yeah, I agree with that part.
I mean, once again, concepts might be nice. Look, for example, use the shuttle, Kelly, as an example. The space shuttle is a great prototype, first-generation reusable spaceship. And it should have been designed with that concept in mind, which means you figure out what works and what doesn't, and then you build your second-generation reusable spaceship, and you keep the process going. But that doesn't work in the government. That kind of concept, that's exactly how things should be done, but that really doesn't work in the government. But what does work when you've got competitive companies each coming up with their own ideas, well, they see what works in the first generation, and they try to come up with their own second generation. And that innovation in competition feeds the system to produce better product. And we have not seen that because we have one design bureau, Soviet style, building all our spaceships.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, after the first flights or so of Columbia, Rockwell made a 200 series proposal for the next shuttle, which would have had metal clad tiles, the access panels, the speed up repair, a whole bunch of other really obvious upgrades. And NASA said, no, we don't want the political hassle of explaining the difference. They probably wanted to keep the labor hours.
It's just that's the way it works. This is why I say they're better off. They don't take the money. Build a product, sell the product, make money on the product. You could sell it to NASA after the fact, and NASA will buy the product. The government, federal government, will buy the product. Might not need NASA to do it, but they're much better off just building their products. You know, and SpaceX demonstrates this, unequivocally demonstrates this, because they went ahead and did it without the government's approval.
Yeah, but there's my second question. I mean, right now, the only people really talking about commercially buying orbital access is Bigelow. And both Lockheed Martin and Boeing work closely with him, and they don't see him as having enough market, or at least not a convincing enough market, they can build for it.
It's not just Bigelow, though, because, you know, Bigelow himself has a contract with six different countries. One of the customers that exists, not one, one of the class of customers that exist are other nations who want to put people in space. for any number of reasons, many different reasons. So there are lots of potential customers out there. And I use the example, once again, of Boeing talking to India as a very good example of that. So I know that you've said this before in commenting on my various blogs on Behind the Black. And, you know, it's a valid point. Is there a customer base sufficient to do this? I think it's much greater than we think. It's much greater than people, a lot of industry people would like us to think, because if you realize the base is greater and there's product to be sold, independent companies can start selling that product, and the powers that are presently in control might not have as much control over the industry anymore.
Well, my concern is, since the major companies like Boeing and Lockheed are basically controlled by stockholders, i.e. pension fund managers, how do you convince them that there's a return on investment there?
Well, you might not, but that's where new companies like SpaceX come in. And once again, those pensioners, those stockholders, they don't want their company to go bankrupt. They're going to be risk. They might be risk adverse, but when they see competition threatening the profits of the company, they're going to put pressure on the CEO and the board to find ways to compete so that the company doesn't go belly up. And I think we've seen indications of that from both Lockheed and Boeing and Grumman, Northrop Grumman, who are starting to face the fact that they're getting competition on the horizon here. If they don't start competing themselves, they're going to go out of business. And so I think don't assume that the stockholders are all going to be super conservative and not in terms of money and not want to take any risks. They want to make a profit. And if they feel other companies are moving in on the market share, if they don't innovate, they're going to put pressure on the company to innovate. And Boeing's shown signs of that. It's been surprising to me, and actually I'm happy about it. I don't expect a Leviathan bloated company like Boeing to be able to shift, but they apparently are trying, and I give them credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, if they can actually convince the stockholders to kind of give them a slack to try for this, that, you know, there actually is a market there. I mean, their resources to actually move in that direction are spectacular. But on the other hand, they're all talking like unless they can get an advanced bid from NASA, you know, there's not enough there for them to move anytime in the near future.
Well, it still comes down to the same thing. If they don't, somebody else will. That's the bottom line. And so Boeing,
I mean, I don't think SpaceX has got any chance at CCDEV. I mean, even Musk thinks he's locked out.
And I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you there, Kelly. Say that again. I just didn't hear it.
Oh, I mean, it doesn't look like Musk, even he thinks he has any chance at CCDEV, a commercial crew, anymore.
Why would you say that? I don't get that impression. Why would you say that?
Well, Musk made a statement out of that, and the fact that Congress is pretty well pointed toward him and SpaceX, you know, the idea of having someone like that take over a commercial crew is so ridiculous as to pull the plug on the entire commercial crew program.
Well, no, I don't get that sense at all. I mean, Congress has different reasons for wanting to limit commercial space. It has to do mostly with pork and supporting the companies. Excuse me, the companies they have been supporting over the years. That's Congress's approach. But once again, if Elon Musk has a contract, when he starts to actually supply ISS with cargo, making a profit in doing that, it puts him in a very strong competitive position to expand his market and his capabilities, his company's capabilities. He's just by reality, the actual doing of it, because he'll be doing the supplying to ISS, not Boeing, and that puts him in a strong position to sell his product to do further, like manned cargo. Manned.
Yeah, 3 years ago I would have said he was a shoe-in, but I mean, right now, and I can see kind of the congressional argument. You know, Musk has launched, what, 6 things in ever. He's never launched people yet. And putting him in the front to launch, you know, the most prestigious thing NASA does is launch astronauts, and turning that over to a startup with no background. And, you know, I mean, so far, 2 of his 6 craft had crashed, and the 3rd one didn't get in the right place. That's political suicide.
The game being played there is the turf war. The companies that have been backed by congressmen who have the pork money, who want to support the jobs in their districts, they're going to favor the big aerospace companies, and so they're going to try to sell those over Elon Musk. There's no question of that. And but he, you know, once again, he can put a capsule in orbit at a tenth of the price of Boeing or Lockheed, and that puts him on the in the commercial market ahead of everybody else, and it means he's going to get customers. He's, if it won't be NASA, it doesn't matter. He's going to get customers because the price is so cheap.
That means, by the way, Kelly,
that in the end, all these arguments are irrelevant because it's the actual price and the doing that matters, not what you think, what you know, Congress or what Boeing thinks. It's the actual doing that matters.
Well, I noticed that when Bigelow was working with both of them, he said that Lockheed's bid for manned launch services was completely competitive with SpaceX's. Because I remember a lot of the new space folks were shocked to hear that.
Well, you see, that's competitiveness. They had to offer something that was competitive to SpaceX because they wouldn't sell the product if they weren't. SpaceX exists. You can't make believe it's not there. And their prices exist, and you can't make believe those prices don't exist. You can't charge five times the price anymore because SpaceX will underbid you. So that forces Lockheed to match the price. It's actually, that's a good thing. And then if they do match the price and they can do it better than SpaceX, well, you know, that's okay with me too. I'm not married to SpaceX. I think they're great, and I think Elon Musk's done a wonderful thing, and he's changed the whole dynamics. But if someone can do better than them, that's great.
Kelly,
yeah.
I need people want to use the line. Do you have anything else, or should I go ahead and clear?
One comment, and then I'll cut it off. Yeah, it's one of the things that interested me is the GAO said that the margin cost for each shuttle flight was only about $60 million compared to like a couple hundred million even for SpaceX. So, yeah, it shows that if you don't have all the overhead of NASA, a lot of these launches can be a lot cheaper.
Yes, you're 100% right. And, Kelly, thank you for the support of Behind the Black. I always appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for not locking me out. When
oh, absolutely.
I
would never
disagree
do
with.
No, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kelly.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. A couple of things, and then I'll well, first of all, listeners, there's still time if you want to call 866-687-7223. And a couple of things. EELB prices are really rising. This is playing havoc with the national science missions and other missions. And if they do man rating on Atlas V or Delta IV, it's probably going to play havoc with that. What incentive do you think SpaceX has to leave a lot of money on the table and keep his pricing pretty low like he has on his website if EELB prices are doubling or maybe even tripling?
Well, he doesn't, actually. Obviously, all he has to do is provide the cheapest price of anything.
He just has to undercut him.
He just has to undercut him.
Okay,
I can't speak too closely to this because I'm not that familiar with the pricing structures enough to understand it. But it's just basic common sense. From his business perspective, he just has to provide the least expensive product.
Okay.
That will get him customers. You know, he wants to have a full manifest. If he makes it too high, even if he's undercutting people, but he's not getting enough product sold, he's probably counts productive for him.
Yeah, because they have to take into consideration his track record or lack of it, all the other factors. Okay, now, Aviation Week. I'm pretty sure it was Aviation Week, although it could have been The Economist, but I think it was Aviation Week. Ran an article about Arianespace, the number one commercial launcher to GTO, being bailed out again by the French government with their subsidy.
Yes.
And it made the comment that the Europeans are really concerned because even though Ariane has the top market share for this market, they cannot compete with what's happening with the private companies in the United States, mainly SpaceX.
Yeah, I saw that article.
Oh, so was it Aviation Week?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so there...
I think it was, yes.
So here... you know, we may see the entire European launch support of Ariane go down the drink because of what SpaceX is able to do, and yet we may have government policies that screw with SpaceX and the market to not allow that to happen in terms of competition. I don't have anything against Ariane, obviously, but I'd like to see SpaceX come out on top in competition.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'd forgotten about that. So I did do a post on it on Behind the Black. Ariane is a government-run operation, and even though it's in the commercial market, it hasn't functioned effectively or cheaply.
Never made a profit.
That's right. This is one of the reasons why there was a market for SpaceX to grab, because these companies were not really functioning like private companies to reduce costs for their customers. Well, maybe that's why Alliant, who builds the engine for the first stage of the Ariane 5 rocket, made the deal to get together with ATK to propose that Liberty rocket.
Hello, yes, of course.
Yeah, because they're looking for a way to make a profit from their technology, and they've got it, and maybe working in a European Space Agency with the Ariane rocket, they don't really have the opportunity to do that. It's not flexible, and they can't make it work. So they figure, we've got the technology. Let's partner with somebody else and see if we can market a product that will beat the pants off of everybody else. And I think that's what's going on.
And in talking to George Sowers a couple of weeks ago over on the ULA side, my take on it is that they're really figuring out and going to become commercially competitive as a commercial company rather than just doing what they've been doing all these years with NASA. I think we're going to see them, even though they're big aerospace with Boeing and Lockheed as their two components, I think we're going to see them learning how to compete.
You're talking about Ariane?
No.
Alliant?
United Launch. ULA.
Oh, ULA. That's a different one. I mean,
yeah,
USA.
Yeah, in the
USA.
I think we're going to see
a proposal to take over two shuttles and do it privately was, once again, a reflection. They're trying to figure out a way to make money without going out of business.
And without sucking off the government to become commercially competitive.
Their problem is that they need to get NASA to let go of the shuttles and let a private company operate them.
And
that's difficult.
Or they need to these cost increases on EELV do not help them in the commercial markets because they're just outrageous. Okay, you have another question, though. This is from Elliot Nixon. Please ask Bob Zimmerman to discuss his thoughts on NASA's recent announcement of a potential lunar sample return rover mission to be carried out through a partnership between JPL and India. This seems a frivolous waste when American Google XPRIZE teams are developing capabilities that are encompassed within a rover sample return mission. One such team has already purchased a launcher, but they haven't paid any money for that launcher, Elliot. But anyway, Bob, go ahead and answer it.
Well, for one thing, it's my understanding that the Google XPRIZE is not a sample return mission. It's for drop a lander on the moon, take photos, and send data back for a period of time, do certain things on the surface. That's one. So Elliot's statement is not correct. Secondly, I just posted this on Behind the Black, this particular story about JPL wanting to team up with the Indian Space Agency to make a proposal to NASA to do a mission, but I'm looking at the article right now. It's a robotic lander into a basin on the moon's south pole to send lunar rocks back to Earth for study. Well, you know, they make a proposal to NASA. It's a sample return mission, which is a very different thing than the Luna X Prize.
Do
not include sample return. It's a very different
form. Yeah, I mean, NASA's functions. Remember, Google Lunar X Prize is just to get a minimum tiny little thing there to basically do something very, very little and call home. And so it's not the same as what they're proposing with India and JPL.
Yeah. And you know, is it a waste of money? I wouldn't necessarily say that. If NASA has the funds to begin with, we're getting back to the basic federal budget. It doesn't matter. It's not necessarily a waste of money. It's a question of whether or not they can afford it.
You're coming up on a two-hour show.
My dog here is complaining, too. You can hear him in the background.
You know what they do with dogs that complain?
In our case, we feed them.
Or you turn them into hot dogs.
No, we feed them. No, don't say that. My wife will get very upset.
So what else do you want to add to today?
Oh, I don't know.
Anything new with the bats in the caves?
It's just spread. It's been found in North Carolina and in Indiana. White nose is spreading as the bats spread it, because the bats are the ones that are spreading it. And there's really not much we can do about it except study the situation so we can learn something about how extinctions in nature
occur. Is this really going to be an extinction
No. It'll be extinction of some species. Other species will move in to fill the niches. For example, one of the things a lot of bat scientists was, one of the lies, I'm going to be blunt again, that some bat scientists were spreading when this first broke out in the eastern United States is that in a year or two when all the bats are gone, we're going to be inundated with bugs because the bats won't be there to eat the bugs. Well, no, what has instead happened is that some other species that eat these bugs, other bat species, since most bat species are not cave hibernating and not affected by the problem, other bat species, other bird species, other insects, have prospered because there's suddenly been a lot of bugs for them to eat. And so other species move in to take over the niche. And we haven't been inundated with bugs in the United States, northeast United States, not even close. It's not a great, it's a tragedy for the bats. I'm not celebrating that. But this is nature. It's Darwin.
And this
and
is
we can study it here.
This is called the white-nosed bat?
No. What it is, let me just give a little background again. White nose syndrome is something that's discovered on bats that die, and what it is it's a white fungus that's found on the bat. They don't know for a fact yet if it's the fungus itself that's causing the problem, but the fungus is a newly introduced fungus that apparently was in Europe until very recently. And it does affect bats, and it affects them in many different ways. It causes them to not be able to finish out the hibernation period, and especially in the northern latitudes, they come out of hibernation too soon when there is no bugs to eat in the winter, and they basically starve to death. The fungus is also very aggressive, and it seems to do damage to their wings, which makes it harder for them to hunt bugs. Whether the fungus itself is the cause of the death is not clear, but what has happened is it has attacked at least five species, maybe six, have actually been attacked by this, and significant drops in population, as much as 90% among those species. Interestingly, some species in the same caves, particularly one that's an endangered species in West Virginia, has not been affected at all by white nose fungus. And so there's a mystery here that's not quite understood.
Now, this comes from Europe, right?
They have found in retrospect that the fungus exists in European caves. European bats are not seen in the same kind of numbers in the United States, and they generally don't hibernate in large clusters. That's been known. What some scientists think is that it could be that this fungus attacked European bats long time ago, because of about thousands of years ago, many thousands, we don't know when, and they have learned over time to adapt to the existence of the fungus, and the species that can manage adapt. In the United States, the species are learning to adapt to this right now. That's essentially the situation.
Okay.
Either they're dying off. That's essentially it.
Has EPA got in to protect them yet?
No, the EPA, this is not an area the EPA has any say in, but we do have issues with government
closing off caves and things, right?
Yes, there is increasing dissatisfaction among the caving community, which has been very cooperative and helpful in trying to solve this problem, but there's a great increasing dissatisfaction with the government's knee-jerk reaction to close caves whenever this is found. And since the bats are the ones spreading the disease, the fungus at least, it seems almost, it's not really relevant to close the caves to keep people out. There are certain situations where it makes sense to close the caves to give the bats a little bit more space, to maybe give them an opportunity to survive a little bit longer. But indiscriminate closing of caves makes no sense, and that's been, unfortunately, the response of the government in too many situations, especially with the federal fish and wildlife.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kelly probably has the last question that came in by email, and he says, lowest bidders can be ignored. Remember Pratt & Whitney's bid for shuttle engines? They had the lowest bid, fully functional prototype engines with hours of burn time and by far the best reputation in the industry, yet they lost to Rocketdyne with the highest cost bid, worst reputation with that kind of engine, and barely a couple of seconds burn time. NASA can and has often ignored blatant facts to give or deny awards to suit their whim, Kelly?
The whim is in politics, and once again, you're dealing with a different time, with a different budget, and a different circumstances, and that is, things have changed. It doesn't mean that wouldn't happen, but the circumstances are different.
Pearls of wisdom, closing comments.
It's 2 hours. I can say this, though, that, you know, if I don't think of anything good to say now, I'll put it on Behind the Black later.
So listeners, do go to his blog, behindtheblack.com. You can also post your comments and hate mail for Bob at the Space Show blog. You
can do it on Behind the Black, too. I have no...
Yeah, so do it on both. And, what is our website? HTTP... thespaceshow.blogs.wordpress.com, and do it to both. We should sync them somehow, so when you're on the show, when one posts on one, it goes to the other.
Oh, I have no idea how to do that.
Neither do I. I'm lucky I know how to edit a posting if I have to. Bob, and until the next time, which I believe is in April, right?
Yeah. I should say, by the way, there is something going to be going on tonight that has nothing to do with budgets, but it's space, and that's Stardust is going to be flying by Comet Temple 1 at about 11:30 Eastern time tonight. And we're going to get a close look at a comet. So this is going to be very interesting because we're going to see images of a comet years after we saw images of the same comet 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So we'll be able to see how it changed in that
video. And listeners, just to support what Bob has been saying in a roundabout indirect way, on February 9th, the head of the Fed, Mr. Bernanke, delivered a message to Congress. We're much closer to destruction than you think. And he says the unsustainable trajectories of deficits and debt that the CBO outlines cannot actually happen because creditors would never be willing to lend to a government with debt relative to national income that is rising without limit. One way or the other, fiscal adjustment sufficient to stabilize the federal budget must occur at some point. The question is whether these adjustments will take place through a careful and deliberative process that weighs priorities and gives people adequate time to adjust to changes in government programs or tax policies, or whether the needed fiscal adjustments will come as a rapid and painful response to a looming or actual fiscal crisis.
That's on Behind the Black. I posted that.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying that this is what we're talking about today with the budget. So.
Yeah. I mean, as Americans, we had better start. Stop acting like little children and face up to reality. David, I always think back with politics. The last few decades has reminded me many times of when I was in the fifth grade in school, and they would have elections for class president. And as kids, we would joke. We'd say to the candidates, "Would you get us an ice cream machine on every floor?" And we were joking. And we didn't seriously mean it, and we also knew if the candidate said yes, that really wasn't the sign of a good candidate, because that's just bribing us with toys. And Americans have actually come to expect their politicians to bribe them with ice cream machines on every floor for the last generation and a half. And it's time we stop being little fifth graders asking for ice cream machines on every floor and start to face reality here, because if we don't, it won't be our children that'll suffer for it. It'll be us very soon.
Yeah, better our kids, right?
No, I don't want it either way. I don't want it either way.
Well, listen, thanks for shedding some light on some obviously challenging things to understand.
All right.
And we will talk to you in April. And when you're headed back home, drive carefully.
We will.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Alan Stern is our guest tomorrow night, talking about the upcoming Orlando Suborbital Conference, and much more. You don't want to miss it. Good night from Bob Zimmerman and myself.